In 1978, Amy Clampett's poems began to appear in little and not so little magazines. Prairie Schooner, Kenyon Review, New Republic, New Yorker, Poetry, Yale Review, River Styx. And then in 1983, her first book, The Kingfisher, was issued by Knopf and was hailed by many critics as an exciting new collection of poems by an exciting new voice on the poetry scene. Many years had gone into those poems that were just beginning to appear. Miss Clampett is a native of the Midwest from a town with the wonderful name New Providence, Iowa. She's transplanted and has lived in New York for many years now. This is her first visit to St. Louis, and I know some of you have been anxiously waiting for this evening. So without further ado, please make Amy Clampett feel at home here.
I knew I was in St. Louis. I came on the train because I saw the Gateway to the West. Is that right? Beautiful sight, even nicer in reality than the pictures made one suppose. So I don't have anything to say yet about Missouri. I have, of course, the Mississippi is a familiar sight, although the Mississippi this far south is not so familiar. Being a Midwesterner, I have written about my native region, and I'm going to begin with a poem which deals with it and brings in some references to the river. It's called The Quarry. It has to do with some fossil starfish, which I have never seen in their native, in the quarry where they were found. I actually saw casts of them in the historical building in Des Moines, but they got me thinking because they look very much like the starfish one sees now, and yet they are millions of years old. Being a poet from the Midwest poses certain problems. It did for me, anyhow. I was a great admirer of the 19th century romantics and saw very little connection between what they wrote and what I saw around me. Can you hear? The thing is, if you haven't had a lot of people before you sort of telling you where what a place is like, it's awfully hard to start out saying what it's like. And so I think that's a problem that Midwestern poets have had and still have. I was helped in the matter of defining my native region by a book I read by John McPhee called Basin and Range, in which he says something which I sort of knew and yet had never really thought about it in that way, namely that the Great Basin between the Mississippi and Missouri rivers has been underwater more than it has been above it. Seas have washed over it, and then they have receded, and then they have come back again. And in the poem I'm about to read, finally, I was thinking about that history of the region I grew up in, Corrie. Fishes swam here through the Eocene, too many fathoms up to think of without suffocation. Light years of ooze, foreshortened into limestone, swarm with starfish, remoter than the antiquated pinpoints of astronomy, beneath the stagecoach, laboring when the thaws came through mud up to the hubs. Midsummer's welling blue stem rose so high, the wagons, prairie schooners under unmasted coifs of canvas, dragged belly deep in grass across the sloughs. No roads. No landmarks to tell where you are or who or whether you will ever find a place to feel at home. No alpine fastness, no tree-profiled Pook's Hill, the habitat of magic, only waves of chlorophyll in motion. The darkened jetsam of bur oaks, a serpentine of willows along the hollows, a flux that waterlogs the mind, draining southeastward by osmosis to the Mississippi, where by night the body of DeSoto, ballasted with sand, or was it armor, sank into the ooze, nudged by the barbels as it decomposed of giant catfish. Others, in a terrain as barren as the dust of bones, kept the corrupt obsession going. Gold. Greed for the metal most prized because by nature it's least corruptible. Flushed finally out of the heartland drain pipe, the soft parts of DeSoto's body filtered into the capillaries of the delta. Will some shard of skull or jawbone, undecomposed, outlast his name as the unquarried starfish outlast the seas that inundated them? Think back a little to what would have been without this festering of lights at night, this grid of homesteads, this hardening lymph of haste foreshortened into highways, the lilt and ripple of the dark, birdsong at dusk augmented by frog choirs already old before the Eocene, the wickiups now here, now there, edged westward year by year, hemmed in or undermined, done in finally by treaties. The year the first land office in the territory opened, when there were still no roads other than wagon tracks, one Lyman Dillon, starting at Dubuque, drove a plow southwestward 100 miles, the longest furrow ever, straight into the belly of the future, where the broken loam would soon be mounted as on a howdah by a marble capital, the glister of whose dome still overtops the frittered sprawl of who we are, of where we came from, with its stilted El Dorado. A little sonnet, which I call The Local Genius. It might just as well have been called The Washing Machine. It has a couple of epigraphs to make it clear where most of it comes from. One of them is from a book by Charles Olson, Call Me Ishmael, which is a very important book to me, although I have to say that I had not known he had written a poem called The Kingfishers when I wrote a poem called The Kingfisher. I have to set that straight. But Call Me Ishmael is as much about mid-America as it is, strangely enough, about Melville and the ocean. And in that book, Charles Olson said, the fulcrum of America is the plains, half sea, half land. Okay, that's one epigraph. The other one is from Glenway Westcott's Goodbye, Wisconsin. He said, there is no Middle West. It is a certain climate, a certain landscape, and beyond that, a state of mind of people born where they do not like to live. Space, spelled large, the central fact, thus Charles Olson. For Glenway Westcott, the state of mind of those who never liked to live where they were born. All that utilitarian muck down underfoot, brown loam, debris of grassroots packed thicker than anywhere else on the planet. Soil, so much of it that the central fact must be, after all, not space but dirt, forever present as the sense of guilt wash day alone can hope to expiate. With what Will Voss of Davenport invented, the Maytags of Newton built a dynasty on getting rid of it. I thought, as I was considering what I might read, that the sensible thing, since I knew there was to be music, would be to read a few poems that have to do with music, some of them rather peripherally. How about Dakota? I think probably all of you know that the Dakota was the name of the apartment house where John Lennon lived and where he was murdered. Some people I know who read this poem didn't, and they still liked it. I cannot figure out why. Most of it actually consists of lines from songs by the Beatles. Grief for a generation. All the lonely people gone, the riffraff out there now mainly pigeons, steps from its limousine and lights a taper inside the brownstone catacomb of the Dakota. Pick up the wedding rice. Take out the face left over from the funeral nobody came to. Bring flowers. Leave them woven with the lugubrious ironwork of the Dakota. Grief is original, but it repeats itself. There's nothing more original that it can do. Another little poem, this is called Berceuse. It came about after I'd been listening to a record of various pieces of Chopin played by different artists. And one that especially caught my attention was Walter Gieseking playing that perfectly marvelous Berceuse, and I've never heard a better performance of it. I was struck by it because I remembered dimly that when Gieseking came to play in New York shortly after World War II, the concert was picketed because he was said to have been a Nazi. I don't know whether it was true or not, but anyhow, that got me to thinking about pure art and impure human nature. Listen to Gieseking playing a Berceuse of Chopin. The moth-wing flutter, light as ash, perishable as burnt paper. And sleep. Now the furnaces of Auschwitz are all out, and tourists go there. The purest art has slept with turpitude. We all pay taxes. Sleep. The day of waking waits, cloned from the phoenix. 1,000 replicas in upright silos, nurseries of the ultimate enterprise. Decay will undo what it can. The rotten fabric of our repose connives with doomsday. Sleep on, scathed felicity. Sleep, rare and perishable relic. Imaginings no shutter against the absolute, incorrigible sunrise. Well, this is a poem called A Hairline Fracture, and its connection with music is indeed minimal, but you may pick up a very slight reference. It has to do with a time I was in England with a very good friend, and things weren't going so well. A hairline fracture. Whatever went wrong that week was more than weather. A shoddy streak in the fabric of the air of London that disintegrated into pollen and came charging down by the bushelful. An abrasive the color of gold dust eroding the tear ducts and littering the sidewalks in the neighborhood of Sloane Square, where the underground's upper reaches have the character almost of a Roman ruin. From one crannied arcade, a dust mop of yellow blossom hung with the stubborn insolence of the unintended, shaking still other mischief from its hair onto the platform, the pneumatic haste of missed trains, the closing barrier. Wherever we went, between fits of sneezing, we quarreled. Under the pallid entablatures of Belgravia, the busy brown facades that were all angles going in and out like a bellows, even the small house on Ebury Street where Mozart, at the age of 8, wrote his first symphony, our difference was not to be composed. Unmollified by the freckled plush of mushrooming monkey flowers in the window boxes of Chelsea, undone by the miraculous rift in the look of things when you've just arrived, the remote up close, the knowing that in another unentered existence, everything shimmering at the surface is this minute merely unremarkably familiar. It was as though we watched the hairline fracture of the quotidian widen to a geomorphic fissure, its canyon edge bridged by the rainbows of a terror that nothing would ever again be right between us, that wherever we went, nowhere in the universe would the bone again be knit or the rift be closed. I'd like to add that it was. Things did get straightened out. It had something to do with the pollen, perhaps. Now, a poem called Sunday Music. It came about after I'd been listening to some Handel, a concerto grosso, as a matter of fact. And I got to thinking about, is it possible to put into words what music is doing? And I'd been talking to some musicians about what is tonality. And I thought for a little bit I knew what it was. Also, behind this poem is something I read of W.H. Auden's many years ago. For one thing, he said music approximates our experience of time. And I thought, yeah, that makes sense. And then he said something about the constant acceleration of the rate of historical change. And understand, this was back in the 50s, before Future Shock got written. And I thought, wow, that is true. And I'd never thought of it before, but I've thought about it a great deal ever since. And so that is also in the background of Sunday music. The Baroque sewing machine of Georg Friedrich, going back to stitch back together scraps of a scheme that's outmoded, all those lopsidedly overblown expectations now severely in need of revision, Ray, the nature of things, or more precisely, back a stitch, the nature of going forward. No longer footpath perpendicular, a monody tootle on antelope bone, no longer wheelbarrow heave-ho, the nature of going forward is not perspective, not stairways, not, as for the muse of Josquin or Gesualdo Sostenuto, a leaning together in memory of things held on to, fusing and converging. Nor is it any longer an orbit, tonalities, fox and goose footprints going round and round in the snow, the centripetal force of the dominant. The nature of next is not what we seem to be hearing or imagine we feel, is not dance, is not melody, not elegy, is not even chemistry, not Mozart leeching out seraphs from a sieve of misfortune. The nature of next is not fugue or rondo, not footpath or wheelbarrow track, not steamships, bass vibrations, but less and less knowing what to expect. It's the rate of historical change going faster and faster. It's noise. It's droids, stone-deaf intergalactic Twitter. It's get ready to disconnect. No matter how filled our heads are with backed-up old tunes, with polyphony, with basso profundo fioritura, with this concerto grosso's delectable back a stitch, allegro. I'm going to conclude with a somewhat longer poem. It's called Beethoven Opus 111. It has to do, certainly, with a piece of music, which I heard for the first time at a recital given by a young man named Norman Carey, to whom the poem is dedicated. Beethoven's last piano sonata. After that, he decided there was nothing more to be done with the form. And maybe he was right, I don't know. At any rate, I was so enchanted by that performance that afterward I began playing records and playing different performers and trying to get inside that piece of music, which seems to have almost the whole world in it. And at the same time, I was aware of another aspect of going to concert, which has never ceased to amaze me, because it takes me back to my childhood in the country, where a concert was a great occasion. And it seemed to me then, and it still seems to me when I go to a concert in New York City, that there is a vast and unbridgeable gulf between the experience of sitting with that instrument on the stage and one performer drawing sounds out of it, between that experience and whatever goes on there and the rest of ordinary life. And somehow that became the theme that is really what I think this poem is about. There is an epigraph from a prose essay by Ossip Mandelstam. There are epochs when mankind, not content with the present, longing for time's deeper layers like the plowman, thirsts for the virgin soil of time. Beethoven, Opus 111. Or, conversely, hungers for the levitations of the concert hall. The hands, like rafts of putty, out of a region where the dolorous stars are fixed in glassy cerements of art. The ancien regime's diaphanous plash athwart the mounting throb of hobnails, shod squadrons of vibration mining the air, its struck oars hardening into a plowshare, a downward wandering, disrupting every formal symmetry. From the supine harp case, the strung foot tendons under the mahogany, the bulldozer in the base unearths a Pyrenean catacomb. Beethoven, ventilating with a sound he cannot hear, the cave-in of recurring rage. In the tornado country of Mid-America, my father might have been his twin, a farmer hacking at sourdough at the strangle roots of thistles in wild morning glories, setting out rashly one October to rid the fence rows of poison ivy. Livid seed globs, turreted in trinities of glitter, ripe with the malefic glee no farmer doubts lives deep down things. My father was naive enough, by nature revolutionary, though he'd have disowned the label, to suppose he might, in some way, minor but radical, disrupt the givens of existence, set his neighbors' thinking straight, undo the stranglehold of reasons nations send their boys off to war. That fall, after the oily fireworks had cooled down to trellises of hairy wicks, he dug them up, rootstocks and all, and burned them. Do-gooder. The well-meant Holocaust became a mist of venom, sowing itself along the sculptured hollows of his overalls, bracelet wrists and collarbone, a mesh of blisters spreading to a shirt worn like a curse. For weeks, he writhed inside it. Awful. High art with a stiff neck, an upright Steinway bought in Chicago, a chroma of a Habermetry Avenue, or of Millet's imagined peasant, the lark she listens to, invisible, perhaps irrelevant, harp strings and fripperies of air congealed into an object nailed against the wall, its sole ironic function, if it has any, to demonstrate that one, though he may grunt and sweat at work, is not a clod. Beethoven might declare the air his domicile, the wind's kin, the tornado a kind of second cousin. Here, his labor merely shimmers, a deracinated album leaf, a bagatelle, the moonlight rendered with a dying fall. The chords subside, disintegrate, regroup in climbing sequences conbrio. There is no dwelling on the sweet past here, there being no past to speak of other than the setbacks. Typhoid in the wells. Half the first settlers dead of it before a year was out. Diphtheria and scarlet fever every winter. Drought, the depression, a mortgage on the mortgage. High art as a caesuris, the silk and perfume of unsullied hands. Those hands driving the impressionable wild with anguish for another life entirely. The Lyceum circuit, the doomed diving bell of art. Beethoven in his workroom. Ear trumpet, conversation, book and pencil, candlestick, broken crockery, the grass piano wrecked by repeated efforts to hear himself, out of a humdrum squalor, the levitations, the shakes and triplets, the adagio molto semplice cantabile, the arietta, a disintegrating surf of blossom opening along the keyboard, along the fence rows, the astonishment of sweetness. My father, driving somewhere in Kansas or Colorado, in Dust Bowl country, stopped the car to dig up by the roots a flower he'd never seen before, a kind of prickly poppy, most likely, its luminousness wounding the blank plains like desire. He mentioned in a letter the disappointment the air could deliver, a groan for someone because he didn't want to look at anything, to take away the flowers, a bawling as of slaughterhouses, slogans of a general uprising, Freiheit. Beethoven, shut up with the four walls of his deafness, rehearsing the unhearable semplice e cantabile, somehow reconstituting the blister shirt of the intolerable into these shakes and triplets, hurrying into flowering along the fence rows. Dying for my father came to be like that, finally. In its messages, the levitation of serenity, as though the spirit might aspire in its last act to walk on air. Thank you.